Hey, podcast family. Glad to have you back for another episode. This week, I get to interview Yvonne Heaviside. She is a British trained health visitor and now lactation consultant in Hong Kong. This is a super fun episode where we get to hear about Yvonne's work history and her life and experiences in Hong Kong and working with all the mothers of the community. As usual, anyone who's ever done a Zoom, you know that there's some little glitchy moments throughout the conversation. So those are present in this episode, but not too much to be disruptive. Yvonne and I obviously had quite a difference in time, me being in America and her being in Hong Kong. So I hope that you will listen, overlook the glitches, and enjoy this episode. Thanks for listening. Welcome to the Journey to Midwifery podcast. This podcast platform is for midwives to tell their story. This is where you get to hear the how and the why a person is called on this journey to midwifery. I'm your host, Amber Wilson, a midwife myself, and I came up with this idea so that all those people asking these questions had a place to go to find answers. I hope you enjoy these stories as much as I enjoy recording them. All right. Well, hello, Yvonne. Thank you for coming on and interviewing with me.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. So as I said offline, a listener actually gave me your contact and said, please interview Yvonne. So I'm excited to hear your story. I don't know it as much as our listeners don't right now. So It'll be good to hear. So let's start with your intro. Tell us who you are.
Okay. Thank you so much. Yeah, my name is Yvonne Heaviside, and I am a British trained registered general nurse, community nurse, health visitor, and international board certified lactation consultant. And I've got 40 odd years experience, and I have been living in Hong Kong since 1995. So it's a kind of a strange kind of podcast in a way that you've got a Western woman speaking, actually, Kongay Fat Choy, third day of Chinese New Year. So quite topical to have me during Chinese New Year. So just to explain about the health visiting background, because I know many of your listeners are in the States, Canada, many people may not know what a health visitor is. In the UK, if you have a baby, the health visitor does home visits after the midwife has finished. So when I train, we're registered general nurses, and then you do a further 18 months training, mostly specializing in child health. And then when I trained, you had to be either a midwife or obstetric nurse. I think now the training's different because I'm a bit out of touch. And the aim of the health visitor is more from a preventative side. So anything, I mean, we used to joke and say from the womb to the tomb in prevention, but most health visitors, and certainly me, work with children under five. So that's what a health visitor is. So when I came to work in Hong Kong in 1995, I came with my husband, whose job brought us here. We were in Australia prior to that, and then we came to Hong Kong. I thought, oh, I'm never going to get a health visiting job. There are things like Well Baby clinics here, which are actually very well run, but they're all strictly Chinese speaking. I don't speak Chinese at all. I understand a little, but I don't speak it. And then one day, as my daughter was doing ballet in the YWCA, and I just saw a notice up on the notice board, and it said wanted health visitor for Matilda International Hospital. So I thought, wow, this is amazing, this is very specific. So I went for an interview and I got the job to work there, and that was to run a Well Baby clinic. So it was doing all the immunizations, teaching classes, and yeah, they were the main two things, part-time to start with. And so I started to work there. It's an international hospital, private hospital. So I was working there as a health visitor. And then I found a lot of my American clients kept saying to me, are you an LC? And I was like, well, you know, of course I know about lactation. I'm a health visitor. I'm, you know, we're trained in that. And then I realized that was a separate qualification. So I then looked into studying and becoming an LC as well. So it was during this time I became an LC. And then SARS hit. So during SARS, many people who had a baby didn't want to go into hospitals. They didn't want to go near a hospital because many of the infections were in hospitals. So I then set up my own home visiting service. Initially, I just called it a Von Heaviside health visitor. And then I changed it to the family zone. And initially it was me. And then along the way, the road, I've had two or three other midwives, mostly midwives, or one pediatric nurse who've worked with me. And then I've had a lady who did baby basics as well, taught baby basics. So I set up my own company, The Family Zone. And that's what I used to do, was teach antenatal classes outside the hospital setting. So for anyone, and then I do a home visit. So either home visit packages, when someone had a baby, they would sign up for a package of five, which would last about a year, or a package of 10. And I did mostly lactation, but not just, people like would sign up if they were adopting a baby, for example, or if they've got issues with a two-year-old that they were worried and felt they needed more support over. But mostly it was lactation, and still is. And then also the other thing I did, which I have done for many years now, is set up a domestic helper first aid and childcare training course. So many people here, both local Chinese and international or foreigners, employ domestic helpers. They are live-in domestic helpers, and they look after their children. They're either Filipino or Indonesian, or sometimes Thai, Sri Lankan, Nepalese, Indian, but the majority are Filipino that I work with. So I was also doing either helper classes or one-on-one helper training. So that was my background. Initially, when I started, I was part of a team, which was actually great. So it was a pediatrician, an obstetrician, and a GP in one practice, and I was part of that practice. And then after some time, they split up, and so then I'm on my own now. So it's nice. I like being part of a team, actually. But I did work for a short time in another very big practice, but that wasn't quite as rewarding as being part of the initial team. So I'm pretty much on my own in my own practice. So that's pretty much my background.
So state the name of your practice again.
The Family Zone Limited.
The Family Zone Limited.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I do have questions. The classes you teach and the homes you visit, even though the families are local, I assume they speak English.
Yeah. I have had a few clients who don't speak English. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of sign language. I once had a lady, she was a very sweet lady who only spoke Mandarin, which is from the mainland, not even Cantonese. And the first visit, her husband arranged a translator for me. So I would speak and then the translator would translate. And then after a while, we realized we could do a lot just by, you know, I'd show the breast and show the baby and, you know, do a lot of sign language. And so I continued doing the visits. And then about 6 months later, she asked for a visit and she wanted to stop breastfeeding. And I said, oh, okay. And she showed me this chest full of frozen milk, a whole freezer full of frozen milk. But she'd been exclusively breastfeeding. And I realized that I'd forgotten in the sign language to tell her to stop pumping after feeding, because initially her supply was low. So I'd shown her all by sign language, put the baby on the breastfeed, then pump afterwards to get your supply up. And she'd religiously been doing this. And it's so funny when you don't speak the language, you just kind of forget the little, you know, and when your supply comes up, then you start pumping. But yeah, in answer to your question, they all speak some English, okay. Almost all. It's rare for me to have. I have a colleague who speaks both Cantonese and Mandarin, so she'll do those for me. But yeah,
so this is a package that your clients just pay for. It's not part of their healthcare.
Yeah, no, it's not part of healthcare at all. Some do get it back on insurance.
Okay.
If they have insurance, it used to be a lot, but now I find the insurance are getting meaner and meaner. And then I'd say more people now do individual visits. So like at the moment, you know, because it's Chinese New Year, everything's closed. And so I'm getting quite a lot of texts or WhatsApp from people who say, hi, my friend's given me your number. I've got blocked up, so I think I've got mastitis. And I'll go and I'll probably never see them again. They just pay and that's it. And then I have other clients who will sign up as soon as they've delivered, and then they'll book a package. But I would say maybe only a quarter of people will get reimbursed through insurance now. They more used to, but not as many now. So it's out of pocket for all of them, yeah. Yeah.
How is the breastfeeding culture there in Hong Kong? Do the majority of women breastfeed? How is it?
Well, it's very interesting because when I first came to work here, I was absolutely horrified because there was like formula advertised everywhere, you know, on the buses, on the MTR stations, mass transit railway. I did a course quite early on in a public hospital, and literally it was like being on a plane where the airline attendant comes with the trolley and says, you know, would you like a drink or some wine or whatever. They would come up and down with milk formula, just saying to all the women, would you like a trolley? Well, of course, coming from England, I hadn't seen that. I was like horrified. But the government in the last 10 years or so have really put a lot of effort into encouraging breastfeeding. I mean, obviously in the government hospitals, they're very short staffed. The care here is very good, but not very supportive. So they have posters all over telling you to breastfeed, but they're very short staffed. So they don't have a lot of lactation consultants still, but they don't offer formula. It's not that they're really trying to become baby friendly initiative hospitals. So that's the public system. They also have maternal and child health centers, and they support breastfeeding in those centres as well. And they're all completely free. But you have to wait, you know, it's just like any public system. You have to wait a long time and you don't see the same person and you have to have an appointment. But that has really helped to increase the breastfeeding. I don't know the statistics. In the private system, it's very frustrating. There are no baby-friendly initiative hospitals in the private system. All the private hospitals have nurseries. And so apart from one hospital, the rest, pretty much when the baby's born, they're kept in the nursery. There's not a lot of rooming in. You can request rooming in, but in some of the private hospitals, they don't even allow rooming in. The baby has to stay in the nursery. It's very old fashioned. And this is part of the Chinese belief in sleep and rest. They believe that the mother should be given as much rest as possible after birth. Also a little bit about following SARS, the superstition not superstition, the fact that there were cases during SARS that were passed in hospitals. And so now they're very strict about, you know, fathers not being there and, you know, not handling the babies, and the baby should stay in the nursery and not be moving around. Personally, I just think that's a bit about control. So that doesn't help breastfeeding. No. You know, and they talk about, oh, the baby's lost weight. Well, of course babies lose weight, so they start supplementing very early. Mm-hmm. So I find in the Chinese who go to the private system, they often are disadvantaged because they're really encouraged to rest and sleep through the night. Even they sometimes give sleeping pills the first or second night so the mom can sleep. So there's very little skin to skin. They're really horrified. If I go in, not that I'm going into hospitals at the moment, but when I was, the first thing I would do is take the clothes off the baby and place the baby skin to skin on the mother. And some of the hospitals would be horrified. They would actually come rushing in and put blankets on. And so initially they don't breastfeed exclusively, but I have found over the last few years the local Chinese are really good at kind of catching up. So once they get the baby home, they really try hard, and they are the ones who will often be breastfeeding for, you know, a year or longer. There's a lot of pumping here. I was quite shocked because, you know, coming from the UK, that wasn't really a thing at all. People either breastfed or they formula fed. Whereas here, a lot of people exclusively pump. That's quite common.
And so I have a question about that. But in the private hospital systems, are these families, I don't know much about the Chinese healthcare system, but are these families that are more affluent that then have the access to these private hospitals?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
So I mean, seems not, you're saying like the more affluent families may possibly be breastfeeding less than the population available that's eligible for public health care.
I couldn't say that as a definite statistic because I'm not aware of many local Chinese. I mean, many of the more affluent people do choose to deliver in public system.
Okay.
So, and then on the other hand, obviously the clients that I see coming from the public system can afford to pay me, whereas there are, you know, many, many people in different social settings who I would never see.
Sure.
So yeah, but I think of my own clients, it's generally, I would say this is sweeping generalization, but what I've noticed is that with my clients that want to breastfeed, the local clients are more determined to persevere.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Western clients here, whether they deliver in public or private, tend to give up more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. There's one thing that's been noticed, and it's not just me, you know, in the international hospitals, I've heard people talk about this, how the milk is often much slower coming in Chinese women. So they tend to hit, it's very interesting. So they tend to hit complications quite early on because the milk is slower coming in. They often have very little colostrum compared to Western women. Then they tend to get more jaundice. So then they're encouraged to supplement with formula. And then they may end up having to stay for phototherapy. And so their breastfeeding starts tend to be slower. But then once they kick off, most of the a lot of the local Chinese clients, so the clients that I have who have family here and are ethnically Chinese do the confinement period. Have you heard about that?
No.
Right. So this was all new to me. And when I came, I was like, what? Like, so they have a very strong belief in looking after themselves for the first month. So for the first month, they don't go out at all. They definitely would not take the baby out unless it's for a doctor's appointment. And then they literally will go there and back again. And they stay at home. They rest a lot. And most of my clients that I see, the Chinese clients, and a few Westerners follow it, will not, never in the month that I'm visiting be out of their pajamas. They literally eat, feed the baby, and rest. They do nothing else. There's no expectation of them whatsoever.
I think that's a fabulous idea.
And do you know?
Can we all do that?
It's grown on me, because when I came, I was like, oh, that's terrible. I had three kids myself and it would have completely sent me nuts. But I'm really growing on the idea. And then they have these ladies called confinement ladies or poor you. And they're quite expensive. And they either come to their house and live with them for a month or sometimes longer, or they come every day. And they cook very specific Chinese foods based on Chinese medicine. Quite bland foods, nothing very exciting, and make them drink lots of soups. Everything has to be warm. They're not allowed anything cold. They're very, you know, you see them even with hats on in the middle of summer, because they're very strong belief on keeping the baby and the mother warm to protect them. No winds or breezes or anything. And they look after them and they give them specific food. So if the milk hasn't come in, or if they're bleeding heavily or not bleeding enough, they adjust the food. So they're all based on traditional Chinese medicine. And so for a month, they're looked after at home. And their job is just to breastfeed, or if they're not breastfeeding, they bottle feed. And then at a month, they can, I think it's a specific day that they have like a celebration, and they're released.
So I'm wondering, and maybe you can give insight into this, but maybe that confinement period kind of makes up for that rocky start, because they are there with the baby constantly.
Yeah, no, I think that's it, because suddenly, you know, from the rocky start and the, you know, baby going to the nursery and everything, they are then completely with the baby 100% of the time. And that's what their job is to feed the baby and to look after the baby and to be looked after. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of strange. And again, you know, when I've gone in to do home visits and, you know, perhaps to help with latching or something, the first thing I do is strip the baby's clothes off. And the confinement lady, or the grandmother, it's not always a confinement lady, but as an elderly, they're usually elderly, or trained confinement ladies, they're like, looking very agitated because they don't want the baby to get cold. And sometimes they're really interested. I've had a few who've asked me for my card and they've wanted to learn. They've said, oh, why are you doing that? And I explain to them about oxytocin and how the baby and the mother's temperature, you know, fits in with each other and how the milk flows best. And then they see it. They see the baby relaxing on the mother. And then I say, look at her, she's stroking the baby. And, you know, they don't all speak English, very few do, but they become very interested. And then they say, oh, can I have your card for my next client? So some are really interested, but mostly they just want the mother to be kept warm and the baby to be warm and for everyone to rest. And they'll do things like bath the baby, very set time in the day, 11 a.m. is bath time. Yes, things like that.
Are there many other people in the community that do what you do?
There are, yeah, it's up and down. There are, I'd say probably like well-known people. There's about four of us. I have a colleague who works with me, but she also has her own practice. She's great. She's Hong Kong Chinese. She speaks Mandarin as well. And she was a sister in a public hospital. So she's got a very good kind of background, whereas my background's a private hospital. So she knows lots of public hospital doctors. She's really great. And then there's a very big practice which has a number of, I think they're mostly British midwives, and some of them are LCs. There are people who annoyingly go around and say that lactation consultants, which, you know, I find it so frustrating because it's so expensive to keep your insurance up and your exams, and, you know, as you know, and they're mostly like retired midwives. So that, I'm not saying they don't know something, but, you know, they probably charge a bit less. But you think, yeah, well, you're not registered, you're not trained. So they're not so good. They're good at the first few days, at engorgement, all the kind of hospital things they could manage, but they're not that good at like mastitis or postnatal depression, that sort of thing. But mm-hmm. I'd say there are a lot of LCs in Hong Kong, and the days when we used to take the exam where you all sat in a hall, you know, and I used to look around and there'd be like 80. But a lot of them do the exam as something to add to their CV, you know, because you think, well, where are they all, you know, or they'd be working in a hospital, but not specifically as a lactation consultant. The public hospitals have only recently introduced lactation consultants. So they would just be, not just be, they would be midwives who would have a qualification as well in lactation consultancy. But as far as home visit goes, not so many until quite recently. The hospitals, I think, to make more money, the private hospitals and the private medical practices have also set up home visiting services from their own midwives, which has been around a few years, which has been a bit of a competition to me, that my numbers dropped a bit. But then, well, as you know, at the moment we're, you know, in the midst of COVID,
yeah.
So there's no, they're not working at the moment. There's no hospital visits at all to the community, no classes or anything. So I'm very fortunate. I've got all of those back again.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty busy, yeah.
I bet you are. That Hong Kong's a huge city.
Yeah, yeah.
So they do have midwives there in Hong Kong?
Yeah, they have midwives, but not there is no public home visiting service. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the same in the US pretty much, mm-hmm. isn't it?
It depends. There are some cities, if they have the funding, they will do home visiting nurses for certain populations, or maybe if they're at risk.
But it's
a nurse. Sometimes they'll do a new postpartum, sometimes they'll do even up to age 5 for the child. So it really just depends on the city and their program that they have going on.
Yeah, because in the UK where I'm from, you know, that's everyone gets it. You mm-hmm. have a baby in a hospital, and then the midwife will do home visits afterwards, then the health visitor will follow on. So but there's nothing like that here. But the maternal and child health centres, they are very widely used. The immunisation rate is very high here. The uptake rate is very high. People are very supportive of public health, I find. They're very interested in it. So it's not an issue like chasing people to get a baby immunised. It's very rare for babies not to be immunised, partly because people are aware the population is so close. You know, that's why we've got so many restrictions here with COVID. And, mm-hmm. you know, the airport's pretty much closed. There's a, you know, for example, there are no flights from the UK allowed in. If you do come into Hong Kong, the only people who can fly into Hong Kong, and this has been the case for months, are those who have residency here. You have to prove that you're a resident. So if, for example, you have a baby, your family can't come, they can't come in unless they're residents themselves. And then once you do come in, you have to quarantine in a hotel at your own expense for 3 weeks. So it's a lot. So people can't leave. or if they do leave and they want to come back, they've got to quarantine for 3 weeks. And then, you know, which, as I say, is expensive. And then from some places, there's just no flights. They have like a blacklist. There are places that they don't allow flights, like the UK is on the list. Even if you are a permanent resident with a base here. So pretty much everyone's stuck here, which is interesting because, you know, I feel very sorry for the mothers here because I don't know if you remember, but, you know, 2 years ago, Hong Kong was constantly in the news because of the demonstrations, the national security law, demonstrations against the national security law. And there was a lot of extreme unrest, which involved many areas of the whole of Hong Kong, not just Hong Kong itself, but Kowloon, the Northern Territories. There was, you know, lots of facilities would suddenly close. There were police, armed police on the streets, certain areas, tear gas, where I had clients where their homes were, you know, affected by tear gas. A couple of my clients, pregnant women, told to leave the office early, there'd be tear gas there. So that was very, very stressful time. Getting about the city was very stressful. There's a lot of tension in the air. And you know, people were either pro the protesters or pro the police. People would never be kind of ambivalent. It was, you know, a lot of opinions. So that went on for over a year. And then just as the national security law was being passed, which pretty much put a stop to all protests, because now if you protest, you're in prison. That, you know, the influence from China is much stronger now. It's not really one country, two systems any longer. So we're just getting to the end of that, and then COVID hit. So it's been, for moms, and dads, it's been a tough few years because, mm-hmm. you know, the airport was completely closed. At one time, the protesters sat in the airport and people would be trying to leave with babies. And a lot of people left at the time, or they couldn't, they're worried about would they be able to get back in, or could they get to the hospital because roads would suddenly close. If they're in labour, what would they do? Or could their doctor get there if they're in the private system? And so they were very anxious. Even where I did my antenatal classes, which is right in the centre of Hong Kong, you know, I remember one night there were just lines and lines of protesters right in front of the window shouting. And, you know, you're trying to create a relaxed, calm atmosphere. And then people are like, and it always amazed me, everyone still came. They all came to the classes and, you know, they weren't kind of put off by it. But it was, yeah, it was quite tricky. So we got all that and wow, now we're into COVID. So now for home visits, people will ask me, oh, again, they vary a lot, but they'll say, is there anyone in your building who's had COVID? Because now the government have to list it. Have you traveled? Have you been in any hospitals? Are you and your husband well? Can you bring the change of clothes? Wearing a mask all the time. Some take my temperature, some spray me all over. So yeah, that's all new and different again. So yeah.
Is anybody open to virtual visits there?
Yes, I've done a few. I find it quite tricky to do with breastfeeding because I'm very hands-on, you know. I'm not, in the UK we were actually discouraged from like touching women's breasts as health visitors. You'd say, oh, you know, use your left hand to support your breast and hold your baby. So when I first came here, that's how I'd been trained. Like if you had a blocked duct, I would advise you how to clear your blocked duct. But here people expect you to do it. They would expect you to massage to clear the duct and mm-hmm. really work at it, or mastitis, and they'd expect you to show them how to latch and examine the baby. So now I'm very hands-on. I find it difficult not to be touching the breast at all. So I have done some. I've done classes, a few classes. And then I've had some clients who've been stuck elsewhere. I had one client stuck in Central America who had some issues. So I did Zoom with her. I had a client the other day who was in Singapore with a very refluxy baby who was looking for, she'd been recommended me. So I did that. But I don't do a lot. I think, when did the last one? Oh, I did a girl on lockdown. So yeah, so she in quarantine. So she'd come in with her baby and we're still in quarantine in a hotel, literally down the road from me, but I'm not allowed to go in. Mm-hmm. And so she'd got some issues. So I could, you'd do a quarantine, do a online consult with her.
So how about you? You've been there for just shy 30 years, right?
Yeah, 20 something years.
Did you come with children or have children in Hong Kong?
Yeah, well, I didn't have any in Hong Kong. So I've got three kids who are now, have a daughter who lives in Canada and she has two girls. And so she's had an interesting midwifery history, I guess. So she delivered the first baby in the UK, and that was great. So she had a hospital birth, but a really good hospital birth. I was with her for both. And then she moved to Canada, and she's outside of Toronto, north of Toronto at the time, in a very quite remote area. And so I went there, and so she had a home birth, which was great. I was very nervous about it, mostly because of the proximity of the hospital, not so much the home birth, but kept thinking if anything goes wrong here, you know, we're looking at least 40 minutes to the nearest hospital. But yeah, she had a home birth. So she's in Canada and she's got two girls. And then I've got a son in London who's got a Russian girlfriend. And then I've got a son in Hong Kong who has a Chinese girlfriend. So the family's like very international. None of them were born here. They were all born in the UK. The first one was C-section, but the other two were midwife deliveries in the UK. And then, yeah, an elderly mother in the northwest of England. So
so your son is right there with you in Hong Kong.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. He's 31, so yeah. He doesn't live at home, but he's the remaining. Yeah.
Yeah. But gosh, you must like it. You've been there a long time.
Yeah. It's a very interesting place. It's a very exciting place. Everything changes. You know, people say to me, well, how can you live there? You don't speak the language. But it's always changing. There's always nice things to do. At the moment, it's really been tough because the government have been very heavy-handed. Even the beaches have been closed off, you know, so there isn't a lot for people to do. From next week they're lifting the restrictions, but bars and restaurants all close by 6 p.m. If you go out for dinner, you're only allowed to at a table. But we're very lucky, we've got two friends with boats, so we've been out on boats with them. One of those was ex-client. Other than hiking, the hiking's great in Hong Kong. People don't realize that, but there's so many hikes you can go on, and they're really beautiful and well kept tracks. So there's hiking, and that's it really at the moment, just because of the restrictions. Meeting friends perhaps outside, but next week that's hopefully going to lift. But yeah, it's the thing that I like about working here is the variety of clients I have, because it's such an international city. So of my clients, I have Russian, Pakistani, Nepalese, Filipino, British, Swedish, Dutch, mainland Chinese, local Chinese, overseas Chinese. I have a lot of those, like American Chinese, Canadian Chinese. I'm trying to think. I think at one time I counted, I've got like 47 nationalities. Singaporean. I've got a lot of Singaporeans at the moment.
You ever get Americans?
American. Yeah, plenty. American, Canadian, South American. And they come and go. And then it's a lot of word of mouth. I've got quite a lot of Americans. And yeah, they're from all over. And that, you know, I'd say the most common reason people are here are for banking, but it's not just banking. You've got someone with Apple at the moment. Used to be a lot of people like in the garment fashion industry, not so many now, that's not doing so well. So it could be bankers, lawyers, tech companies, some shops. But yeah, just a big variety. And that's what's interesting, because they all bring different things. And then you do one client, say visit one client for a number of years the first baby, and then a few years later they'll have another one, and so you go back again. And I have one client who's had six who I've looked after, so I keep saying to her, just have the seventh and then I'll retire. So she's Hong Kong, but not Chinese. She grew up here. So, and that's another group. You've got lots of Indians. So I have Indians who come from India who come mm-hmm. to work mostly in the banking system. And then there's a lot of Hong Kong Indians. So you have that group as well. So, yeah. So those people. And then some I've had recently, a client who I looked after when she was born, who's had a baby.
Oh, that's so special.
Was nice. Yeah, that was really special. And another client who had a baby, and then her husband left her, so he never lived with her. And so then 17 years later, so she kept the baby and was a single mom all that time. And then 17 years later, she met someone else and has had a second baby. So 17 years later. So wow. That, you know, that's all interesting. It's all kind of exciting, and part of the just being in a community where, you know, you're known, and you see your clients all over the place as well. Because it's quite small, although it's a big city. Most of my clients are in a kind of smallish area, so you're always bumping into them.
It sounds just so rich in culture and diversity. Yeah. And have you felt it a struggle at all that you didn't speak the local language?
Yes, it is. I mean, to be honest, it's a very British thing, isn't it? That British people don't speak anything other than English. You know, but I do wish I could speak just to be more polite, you know, especially at the moment. You know, it's Chinese New Year. People are very cheerful in the streets and they're wishing you best wishes, and they might say a bit more. I mean, I know the words to respond, but and you just think, oh, I just wish I could be polite and answer. And so the toughest times for me are parking my car, because obviously the car park attendants, they don't speak English, and you know, you wouldn't expect them to. That's what they're there for. That, you know, they're not there to, you know, it's not an office job or whatever. So I get to a building and I tell them which flat I'm going to, and they'll go, cannot, you know. And I know there is parking because my clients tell me, and they're like, they always say cannot. And then you try and talk to them to say it's okay, yes, they've reserved a space, and they're just like shaking their head, and you feel a bit, oh, I just wish I could say, you know. So then I end up calling the client who mostly can speak to them. But that, yeah, that can be frustrating. The doctors and everyone, they all speak English, and you know, most people speak English. I mean, I was doing a visit last year during the demonstrations for my Chinese colleague, and I was in a very remote area that I wouldn't normally go, very local area. It was a lady with a breast abscess, and it was right in the heart of the demonstrations. It was a public holiday, and I went on the mass transit railway, the equivalent of the tube, the subway system. Did the visit into this area, and then I came out and I got back on the platform, to go back onto Hong Kong Island. This was way off Hong Kong Island. And then there's an announcement in Chinese, which is unusual because usually they announce in Chinese and English. And then people were like, oh, like that. And then they just all started walking off the platform. So I was like, oh, what is it? So it took me a while to find someone to speak English. And then eventually I found someone and they said, oh, the government have closed all public transport. And this was to stop the demonstrators getting to the point because things were bubbling up. So they just stopped. And I really didn't know even where I was because it was an area I didn't know. Like if I'm on Hong Kong Island, I can pretty much walk everywhere because I'm a big walker. So I know it like the back of my hand. If I'm in the remote spot, I could still walk because, you know, I can hike and I know the area. But this is on Kowloon Side and I'm not a clue where I was. And so I started to walk and I saw like a bus depot, but the buses were all closing down and they were driving away empty and there were crowds everywhere, no signs of any taxis. And I got the scales and, you know, heavy bag. And I thought, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. And then I thought, oh, you know what? I'll walk against the crowds into like a public housing area and hope I can find a taxi, because if I can find a taxi, maybe he'll drive me across or drive me to somewhere, I don't know where, because you need a ferry to get across the water if you can't use the system. And then this old man, just kind of quite scruffily dressed old Chinese man, and he said, are you looking for transportation? And spoke perfect English. And I felt so ashamed. I thought, you know, I'm in this area where you wouldn't expect anyone to really speak English. And I said, yes, I'm trying to get back onto Hong Kong Island. And then just then a cross harbour bus was coming. It wasn't a bus stop. And he literally flagged the bus down, spoke to the bus driver in Chinese, motioned me to get on. And I got on and it was just me and one other Filipino lady on the bus. The bus didn't stop anywhere else. And it went right across the bridge, across the harbour, and took me back to Hong Kong.
Wow. What a story.
I wouldn't have known. And I would certainly never have stopped the bus. I had no idea that even was a bus that would cross the harbour at that point. But yeah, people help you. They do help. And there's always someone you can try and find. I was trying to do a visit the other day and I just couldn't find it. And lots of people I asked didn't speak English, but then eventually someone saw me and they came and said, can we help? And it was a bit complicated, so they helped me. So it's frustrating. I think it would help, definitely. Mm-hmm. I would probably have more clients as well, but there have been times when I've just so booked up that I haven't needed any more clients. But mm-hmm.
They help you because you have a flashing sign over your head that says, I speak English. Is that what it is?
It's more like a perplexed look on my face.
Yes.
I'm lost.
Yeah, but that's probably a tough language to learn.
Yeah, it's very tough. We did try when we first came. My husband's actually quite good at languages and he went for classes, but he didn't get very far. And I once got in a taxi and gave my address to the taxi driver, and I at the time we lived in Repulse Bay Road, and I said Chin Soi Wan Dou, which is Repulse Bay Road, and the taxi driver went miles in the opposite direction. And then in the end I was like, oh no, where are you going? And he's like, Chin Soi Wan Dou. And I should have gone Chin Soi Wan Dou instead of Chin Soi Wan Dou. And he was taking me to Clearwater Bay Road, which is like on the other side of, it's across the harbour. So after that, I thought, I understand little things. But
so your husband does not speak it either?
No, he understands quite a lot. My son, my son understands quite a lot, but I don't really understand much. But yeah, my husband, even though he went for classes, he can speak more to the taxi drivers, for example, or, you know, there's a workman and he can say a little bit. But I don't. I've given up.
Did your kids?
As I say, the clients.
Did your kids go to school with children that spoke Chinese, or was it bilingual?
Yeah. So they went to an international school here, but in the international schools, there's lots of Chinese speaking kids because they're maybe Canadian Chinese, American Chinese, or British, I mean, they had, in their school, they had 47 nationalities. So there were lots of kind of Chinese kids in the school, but they often wouldn't be able to speak Chinese either. But no, they don't speak it either, which is terrible. I remember when we came here, the option was for language in the school was French. It wasn't like Mandarin or Cantonese wasn't even an option. And I remember my daughter had one friend who was doing Mandarin, and she used to go on Saturday mornings to Mandarin classes. And she's actually now a Reuters journalist, interestingly enough. So it obviously paid off. Mm-hmm. She was the only person that we knew who did it, like Mandarin. But I have friends here who've grown up here. So they're like Indian, and some will be fluent Chinese speaking, mostly because of their armor, because of the domestic helper who looked after them, taught them. So that's how they learned. But I have other friends who grew up here, who were born here and don't speak a word of it.
Isn't that wild to spend your whole life somewhere and not speak the language?
Yeah. And it seems a bit arrogant, but I can see how it happens because you don't need to. It's Hong Kong's very international. So it's only, you know, as I say, like parking your car, or the police all speak English. And they're pretty helpful. Twice last year, my car was hit by completely innocent party, but you know, one day a taxi driver decided to do a U-turn. I'd just seen a patient in an area I wasn't familiar with, just driving along. And then this taxi driver saw a fare, I think, on the other side of the road. I didn't see him and just drove straight into my car. And he'd speak a word of English then. And, you know, but the police will come, they come and they're very quick and they just translate everything for you. And then a few months later, I was doing a visit and we have typhoons here and they're on different levels. And it was a level 8 typhoon. So you're not really supposed to go out in a typhoon because of the car insurance isn't valid. And blame me, I'm driving along and the road is completely empty. And this man, I think because the road was empty, wasn't expecting to see anyone, just drove, interestingly, out of a police station and hit my car. And again, the police came and translated everything. So it's a bit, yeah. But luckily that one was all sorted out. Yeah, but that's just another thing. Yeah. You have typhoons, there's always something. Where days were, you know, you're supposed to go out at all, or different rains, amber rain, red rain, where the rainfall is so heavy, and I might be doing a visit somewhere, and then it suddenly comes from nowhere, and you literally can't see in front of your car.
Wow, sounds like an amazing place. Interesting.
Yeah, it is. I think it would be very hard to work anywhere else now because of the variety and the drama. You know, there is always a bit of drama, but also the people, they all have different stories. Well, I suppose that's the same anywhere, but yeah, the people are very interesting. And I have, at the moment, I have, one of my old clients, her domestic helper, she has a Filipino domestic helper. And her and her husband, who's a driver, have had a baby. So my client has bought a package of 5 visits for me to visit them. And they live in this, it's a multi-occupied space. There's no lounge or anything. It's just, they just have a bedroom in what they call a guest house. And it's so tiny, there's nowhere to put the scales down to weigh the baby.
Oh my gosh.
No flat surface. Which, you know, that's the first for me. I've never done visits in a guest house like that. But I've been to hotels, or but not in these multi-occupied homes. So that's the first. That was interesting. And then another one, a Nepalese girl, some kind colleagues bought two visits for her. And she's in one of these kind of real, you always see them on the movies, these buildings where, you know, it's literally, you've got high rise all the way around. And so there's it's all joined together. And then there's just this narrow courtyard that you look down into from the buildings. And again, I'd never been inside one of those before. I've seen them. So this girl lives in there. So that makes it very interesting.
Do you keep a journal of all your visits? Like your experience? Oh gosh, you should. You should write them down.
People often say that to me. Yeah, people often say, yeah, because yes, yeah, exciting things have happened. And I've just not, you know, because you're so tired when you get home.
Yeah.
Do the notes, but yeah. And then sometimes, you know, I've done visits to the islands. You go off on the ferry. There's lots of little islands here, and you'll go on the ferry and it takes ages to get there, and then the weather changes and, you know, the storm might come, and then you go back on the ferry in the storm, and I'm sit there and I think, oh yeah, you know, it's a kind of privilege to be doing this, but also you want to get home and get some dinner. And one visit, a one-hour visit will maybe take 4 hours, you know.
Yeah. But gosh, I just can't imagine like reading your journal and what a delve into another culture that would be. Such a good experience. Yeah. You have to maybe pull from your memory one day and start to write these things down.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting. And, you know, like things like postnatal depression, it's very difficult to manage that. I was thinking about a journal recently with this client I've had, who really, really needed help. And here they don't keep the mum and baby together. And then, you know, what do you do with the baby? Because the mother's in hospital and been sectioned. And then there's no family here. And then, you know, I had to try and help to find someone to look after the baby and keep them together. And, you know, that in other countries, there's a whole team of people doing stuff to help, whereas here there isn't that support. And of course, you know, under normal circumstances, you get the mother from her country, she was from the UK, but she couldn't come in because of the restrictions. And yeah, I was thinking, oh, I should write all this down because it's very relevant to the age we live in, and how to deal with these things and what really needs to be done. It just shows the isolation. And the way people accept it, oh, sorry, no, we don't have a baby, mum and baby unit for women with severe postnatal depression. So, you know, how could that possibly help with bonding and empowering?
Right. And sometimes being away from your baby in some cases is the worst case when you have depression.
Yeah, no, absolutely the worst case. And then the husband's having to work and then try and visit his wife. And then the other thing that happened that I kept thinking I should be more involved in was that they stopped the husbands in the public system attending the birth or visiting hospitals at all. And so I know that's happened in other countries, but a big group of women really lobbied the government because they said absolutely no husbands or partners allowed the hospital, and that's very hard to give birth alone, and then afterwards, and you know, so I signed the petition, but I felt, you know, oh, I could have done maybe more. There was another midwife who actually did more, who I vaguely know, and then the government quite recently did a U-turn. But the allowance now is that the husband can go in, but he has to have a COVID test. So, you know, when if your wife suddenly goes into labor and you had your COVID test on Tuesday and today's Saturday, that's that's not relevant, that it's got to be within the last 72 hours. So they're all like having COVID tests almost like every other day towards the delivery time, which is, you know, unusual times and hard for them. And then, you know, going, if the husband can't be there, the partner can't be there, going to have your baby alone where you have to wear a mask during the delivery throughout, which is very uncomfortable.
Yeah. So intimidating.
And intimidating. So, yeah, I've often thought that would be interesting to write about that as well.
And just to remember this moment in history.
Yes, yeah, exactly, because it's so unique, you know, in a year's time, hopefully, well, let's hope everything will be back to normal. I think because I was here during SARS, that was very eye-opening, and it was like, during SARS, many of the Western people left Hong Kong. They just left. You know, one doctor I know, an obstetrician, 80% of his patients left. They just all got on planes and left Hong Kong. But the people who were left here, you know, they were very anxious, very anxious. So I kind of felt I was a bit prepared for it, having been through that, and just reassuring them, making sure they can see you washing your hands and, you know, you're careful about PPE and everything. But yeah, to be here again, but obviously it's much wider, it's global, isn't it? So
do you feel like this is worse than SARS the first time around?
Yeah, I think it is, yeah. I mean, SARS was very scary because nobody really knew what it was. And people were dying, you know, and you know, it was, and it affected mostly Hong Kong, Canada, Toronto, and China. But like Hong Kong, it was like in the news, and you hear a doctor's dying. And so it was very scary, and you didn't know how long it would last for and how it would affect pregnant people or little babies. In fact, it didn't seem to affect them at all. Whereas this, there's so much, like you're watching the news, watch the BBC World Service or CNN, or there's always information about it. So I feel very informed. But we haven't got the vaccine yet. That's probably, I think I read yesterday, not going to come till March.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so there'll be no vaccine yet. So that, I think once we get the vaccine up and running, that will help. But the population is just so close, that's the problem here. Everywhere's very crowded, which is why, you know, the traditional not going out for a month with your baby makes sense, because they are very vulnerable then. And you know, in the old days, when people had a cold in the lift and they sneezed, they wouldn't cover their nose. It's not really the practice here. Spitting in the street was very much the practice when I first came, very common. And then people, strangers, will come and touch the baby. They'll pinch the cheeks.
Oh.
So that's all part of the practice here, the not practice, the tradition. So you can understand why, you know, the confinement period, where it comes from, protecting the baby. So I think it's a good thing here, like, don't go out unless you have to, keep the baby at home. But I have noticed in some of my clients with like 4-year-olds, of course they're all homeschooled and have been for months and months and months, they're starting to get a bit anxious about going out. They don't want to go and play outside. They just want to stay home. And so I think it's going to have some effect on, like, the little people. They're becoming more introverted, and, you know, and also because there's so little they can do at the moment, with so many parks, the parks are closed, the beaches, as I say. But so I don't know what effect that will have on them, but I suppose it's the same in many places. It's at least we're not in complete lockdown here. At least we can go out.
Yeah. Well, Yvonne, I've taken up enough of your time. This was super fun. I mean, we talked about your story, which was good, but I know that everybody's going to love to hear just about life in Hong Kong. I think that's so interesting. So much I didn't know.
Oh, well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah.
Very good to talk with you.
Yeah. Anything else you want to share?
No. I think I've pretty much covered it, all the things that are different here. I mean, that's the thing. It's the difference. It's just the variety, the foods, not drinking cold, and, you know, confinement period, all that. That's very different probably to what other cultures would experience. But then the pleasure of working with so many different nationalities in a single day, or being, you know, able to be privileged to be part of their birth period, and, you know, for up to 5 years. So yeah, thank you. And thank you for everything you do with your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
It's very interesting to hear all these different stories.
It's fun. I feel privileged to hear them all myself. Yeah. I get such a kick out of talking with all of you, and you know, it's fun. I enjoy it. I keep coming back to do it.
Good for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Keep it up.
Thank you.
All right.
So as you heard, this was not the typical podcast episode about midwives, but Yvonne's work definitely relates to midwifery and everything we are interested in. So if you loved this podcast as much as I loved talking with Yvonne, you could please take a moment and leave me a review on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you are listening on. And remember, as usual, if you want to contact me, you can find me at journeytomidwiferypodcast@gmail.com. I'm also on Instagram and Facebook at journeytomidwiferypodcast. And I appreciate you listening, coming back week after week. And until next week.